Well, today's talk is on AI and nephrology. I'm Mel Spiceman. So today, kidneys. Now, we're going to do nephrology and hypertension. Why hypertension? It's a little tricky. Hypertension tends to fall into cardiovascular disease, but it is the main cause of kidney disease as well. So as you guys know, we're nonprofit, 501c3, and I have no conflicts of interest, no financial disclosures. I'm just here to teach. You guys really like when there's a case integrated into the talk. So I've been going out of my way to make sure there's some cases that fit into the talk. So the first one is a 69-year-old man who comes to the emergency room here with left arm and left leg weakness. Not surprisingly, the MRI reveals a stroke. But when patients have stroke, we want to think about why did they have it, not just treating them and rehabbing them. You don't want them to have another stroke. So stroke tends to fall into either being hypertension as the mechanism or AFib. And you can tell based on the location of the stroke whether it's hypertension or AFib, because hypertensive strokes tend to be in the basal ganglia, whereas AFib strokes tend to be in the cortex of the brain. So this MRI showed a basal ganglia stroke. So that tells us that hypertension is the reason or the mechanism of stroke. So the real question is, what can we do as physicians to prevent a stroke using AI? Now that we have this tool, can we use it to help prevent a stroke? And the way that it would help prevent a stroke would be finding the hypertension before the patient has a stroke. They refer to hypertension as the silent killer, meaning patients are completely asymptomatic and walk around with really high blood pressures, and then they come in unexpectedly with a stroke. And then our role and as internal medicine doctors is to try to find it before they have the stroke, because it's really devastating. So what's exciting is that just in the last month, there is now, through the Apple Watch, the ability to use the watch as a tool to detect undiagnosed hypertension. This was released in September. So now we're in November. So it's actually 2 months ago. How does that work? Because it doesn't actually measure your blood pressure. So how does AI know your blood pressure if it's not, if there's no cuff, it's not actually measuring your blood pressure? But it could do so very accurately using these methods. So when I say these methods, I'm going to show you 8 different AI tools that are currently exist for blood pressure. None of them actually measure your blood pressure with a cuff. They just use one of these 3 methods. So pulse transit time, photoplethysmography, which is how the Apple Watch tool works, or pulse wave velocity. But these are cuffless. What's really interesting is they're continuous. Why this is important for us in the room is myself and Dr. Ann, we have been hospitalists in the teaching program for a long time. And as hospitalists, you don't normally have a continuous monitoring of someone's blood pressure. If they're on a floor, it gets checked every 8 hours or something like that. Even in the ICU, if it's automated, the cuff only inflates every 15 minutes. But I'm going to show you some tools that are for hospital medicine or ICU care that can allow for continuous monitoring. I think that could be like really cool to be able to do it continuously. But let's talk about the one that will impact screening and detection in the general population and hopefully will lead to stroke prevention. by alerting someone who doesn't know they have hypertension that they have it. So on September 12th, which is literally, I think, 8 weeks ago to the day, Apple released HTNF is the abbreviation, or hypertension notification feature. So it works by light bouncing off your blood vessels. That's the photoplethysmography. Now, aside from the tool that's on the Apple Watch, ones that have been developed and deployed in the hospital settings primarily, there's seven of them. I'm just going to quickly show them to you. Now, the Apple Watch tool, you could use it today, right now, on yourself, on your patients. These other ones tend to require the hospital to, like, purchase an expensive system. But not the first one. The first one's a ring. So aside from the watch as a wearable, you probably have heard there are rings. This one is specifically was studied in hypertension. So it's the brand, and I really don't like to talk about brands, but for the hypertension tools, I'm going to tell you the brands. I'm not advocating any of them necessarily, just this is information. So Caretaker VitalStream came out in 2021. That was a ring that used pulse transit time to measure blood pressure. Now look at this. It was comparable to an arterial line. When I was in your shoes, I would put in arterial lines in the ICU. It's painful. Oh my goodness. For the patient, it's excruciatingly, not so much a venous puncture, but arterial lines are painful to put in. So can you imagine you could completely avoid that and get ICU type data just by putting a ring? Now, Anne and I were discussing this the other day, and she said, well, what if they get edematous and you can't take the ring off, right? That could be a problem.
Unless it hooks around, I don't know, and then it can separate.
Yeah, I mean,
I wouldn't put a ring on somebody in the ICU unless there's an easy out, because it might swell.
I like the rings for someone who's just ambulatory and healthy to monitor them, but I don't know, not sure why they went with the ring approach, or whether it's
an idea, because this hurts when you can.
Yeah, right. The fact that it's, like, from a measurement point of view, comparable to a line, to me is so cool. And as a hospital physician, I think this would be amazing if the hospital would have access to it for us in an ICU setting. So
it has to be something that separates.
The next one that came out was called BioBeat device. That's in 2022. Now this it's like a strap that you wear on your chest, torso, or wrist. And it uses PPG, which we already talked about, as the way to measure the blood pressure. And in terms of how accurate it is compared to the ground truth, it's within 3.8 on the systolic and 3.1 on the diastolic. So pretty good. It said the best outcome was used in a clinical set, in an inpatient setting. Again, other than this Apple Watch tool, most of these have been studied more in the hospital setting, which I think when you're a resident doctor, you're mostly doing hospital training. So all this applies to your day-to-day things that you see. Now, the next one that came out was in 2023 called Pyramese. Now, this was not relevant to internal medicine, so I'll briefly mention it was for neonates in a neonatal ICU. And it was to the level of 0.8 on how accurate it was. So not commercially available outside of the NICU. And then Simple Sense, this was one that anyone could use. It's a chest-worn cloth device, and it has multiple parameters. But all these tend to use the same method of measuring blood pressure. It says that this came out in 2024, but it was only been used in trials, and it was costly, so... one more is called Cardi, not Cardi B, but Cardi X. It's a wrist-worn. It uses pulse waves via PPG and ECG to monitor the blood pressure. There's one more that's out there called Live Metrics Live One, also a wrist wearable. And it was the accuracy in healthy volunteers in an ICU setting was 0.7, like on how accurate it was compared to their real blood pressure. So that's amazing, like how good it is. And then the Hylo bracelet, Actia Hylo bracelet, that was in this year, 2025, uses PPG and pulse transit time to measure. So there are a lot of devices that have been developed. This last one, the bracelet, only costs $250. So just be aware that if you have a patient, whether it's in the hospital or outside of the hospital, there are AI tools. There are many now that could continuously measure the blood pressure. So if you wanted to use it yourself or on one of your patients, you can either do a watch or a ring for a reasonable cost. A significant percentage of Americans own a smartwatch. So with almost no effort, you could just start doing this right now in clinic today, if you have clinic today. So I'm moving on. So still in the nephrology category, so in the MixApp book, besides hypertension and the classic kidney diseases, electrolyte disorders are considered in the nephrology category. So we're going to talk just briefly about how hyperkalemia, as it relates to chronic kidney disease, can be detected using artificial intelligence. Now, if you were at my cardiology talk here, I mentioned that you can use computer vision to look at an EKG, and it could detect things that maybe don't have to do with the heart, like anemia or chronic kidney disease or diabetes. Well, it can detect hyperkalemia, but we actually can detect hyperkalemia, right? If we saw peak T waves. But even before it gets that bad, because AI can see patterns that the human eye cannot see, it can alert you to hyperkalemia. So this was just published, well, no, actually, this was published a year ago in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. It was called Validating Non-Invasive Detection of Hyperkalemia Using AI Through an Electrocardiogram in High Acuity Settings. So again, it would apply to hospital medicine. And area under the curve, pretty good. Like, I like to see numbers in the 90s, 0.88. It's pretty close. Sensitivity, specificities in the 80s. For a first try, not too bad, I guess. So what was the conclusion of this study? That you could use AI to look at your EKG to demonstrate whether or not you just quickly, let's say it was a code situation, and you're not going to get the lab back instantaneously. I mean, how many times do we in our code thinking try to determine should we treat for hyperkalemia, right? It's always in our thought process. So you could, if you had the ability, you could do the tracing during the code. If you could then have AI read that tracing acutely, you would know instantaneously, is there hyperkalemia or not? And the thing that's noteworthy in this study is it has a really good negative predictive value. It's a good rule-out tool. Like, acute setting, got to know right away, before the labs are going to come back, you could rule it out. It did have a low positive predictive value, so maybe not the best for ruling it in, but definitely helpful for ruling it out. Now, October of 2025, which was just a few weeks ago, another study on this, AI and hyperkalemia, evaluating immediate potassium lowering on mortality. Role of artificial intelligence in reading the EKG for predicting mortality. So in this study, which it's just the late, like you can't get later than this. It's just literally a couple weeks ago. AI was useful for detecting hyperkalemia on an EKG and reducing mortality risk. So I'm excited about this. I think this is, we're going to be speaking in a few weeks. Anna's going to be talking about how to use AI to look at the EKG and see things that we discussed. We have a talk in Paris coming up. So this is where things are at now, is using computer vision to look at an EKG. We can get an EKG so fast. Sometimes it's done in an ambulance. If we can look at that EKG, we can find life-threatening things very quickly before blood is even sent to a lab. So the potential here is just really amazing. So let's go and do another case. A 68-year-old woman was admitted for pneumonia. She's receiving IV antibiotics. Her creatinine was 1.4, and 72 hours later, it went to 3.1. So that's acute kidney injury. But the question, again, like with hypertension, is there a way now that we could use AI to prevent this from happening? Well, there must be, otherwise I wouldn't have made the slide, right? So New England Journal of Medicine, as you guys know, about a year and a half ago, has a separate version that's just AI papers. And this one was from February of 2024, so last year. It's almost 2 years old. And this looked at a tool that's would be available to today to everyone in the room. Like you could go out of this door and use this right now because it's on Epic. It's on Epic. Do you guys use Epic? You could go out of the door right now and use this right now. So it's not like, oh, this is a theoretical thing. What I'm teaching you today, you can use in clinic with the watch because many people have a watch, and you could use this on Epic when you walk out the door. So you could do it. It's not just, we're not just like theory. This is usable right now. This study looked at the Epic tool. Now, I'll just say, no disrespect to Epic. Most of the Epic tools don't perform as well as the AI tools that are being developed now. But it's a good proof that it would work. I'll just tell you and show you that there are many other similar tools that might be better than what you have access to in Epic. So the case I gave you was hospital-acquired kidney injury, or HAAKI. As hospitalists, we saw this a lot, especially with antibiotics, especially when the emergency room gave empiric vancomycin and piperacillin. When they did that, oh my goodness, how many people, by the time they came to you guys on the floor, went into acute kidney injury. It was ridiculous. So the case I gave was somebody that got antibiotics, went into acute kidney injury. We tended not to be, none of us here in the room tended to be the ones responsible. It was actually happening from the emergency room. So, but how could AI prevent that? So basically, a machine learning model, this one's built into Epic, it will tell you the risk of developing acute kidney injury from the moment the person's in the emergency department, which is when we're trying to intervene before they go into AKI. This was done prospectively, and it was done between 2022 and 2023. And they had a lot of patients. They had 39,891 patients. Now, for this tool, the one that I said you have access to right now, area under the curve was only 0.77. We like numbers in the 90s. So it could tell you 48. So let's say you're seeing the patient now, they just came to you from the emergency room. The tool, if you used it now, would predict whether 48 hours from now, are they going to be in AKI or they're not going to be in AKI. And the predict the so that was 76 or 0.76 error under the curve. And positive predictive value, 88%. Not a great sensitivity. So the people who did the study were just testing the Epic tool. This wasn't funded by Epic. It wasn't, an industry study. This is just people like us testing the tool. like you were doing informatics last year at Cook County, you could have tested a tool like this, and that would have been an informatics project, you know. So the takeaway from this study was it was just okay. And so, like, I'm not excited about using the EPIC tool because it was just okay. But it did provide early identification of those at risk for AKI. It shows that this is called clinical decision support, what we're discussing, that could provide clinicians, you know, warn them about someone at high risk for AKI that they may have otherwise missed. So it's a predictive model. Now, that's only one study. I'll just tell you, there are good tools, not necessarily the one I showed you, but there are good tools you could use. So I think as, like, we get to pick and choose what medicine or drug we want to prescribe for a problem, right? If somebody comes to you with heart failure, you're like, okay, we want ACE inhibitor, we want beta blocker. We decide, right? Well, in the same way, you could decide what tool you're going to pick to use to prevent kidney disease. So this was a really nice systematic review and a plug for our research lab. So Ann and I mentor residents in our virtual research lab. You're welcome to join. I'll show the contact information at the end. But we do projects like this one. And this one was a review of all studies for AI and acute kidney injury, all the tools that are available. And they found, this is amazing to me, I showed you one paper. There are 4,816 papers on AI tools for acute kidney disease. These are all different tools. So this was from a PubMed search. So if you pull all the data on it, you could see the numbers are similar, area, you know, 0.82, 0.78, so not in the high 90s. So, conclusion, most validated models perform, they're calling this performance well. So I think we still have some work to do in the realm of improving tools for AI and AKI. They perform well at AKI onset, severity, complications in hospitalized adults. So just be aware that the tool exists. You could use it. It's not like a stellar tool, but it's there. Another case. So we talked about hypertension. We talked about acute kidney injury. Now this is an 82-year-old woman who has chronic kidney disease. GFR of 9.7. What could you have done to prevent it from getting to 9.7 using AI? So this was besides the New England Journal, the other journal that's really highly regarded is called Nature. And so they have one for artificial intelligence and medicine called Nature Publishing Journal. That's NPJ Digital Medicine. And this was a trial on a chronic kidney disease tool. Now, the thing that's interesting that hopefully you'll be like, how is this even possible, is the way it worked is it looked at a picture of your eye, a retinal photograph. So
In non-diabetic patients, right.
So the original work on AI and kidney and AI and medicine was for diabetic retinopathy, but there's a field that has emerged called oculomics, and basically, you take a photograph of your patient's eye, retinal photograph, and you could do that in the primary care office, and AI will look at the photograph and see diseases that are not even eye diseases. And so in this case, it could tell whether or not the patient has chronic kidney disease. It does so by looking at the blood vessels. So in this study, they developed a tool called RET-CKD, and it would predict, let's say you don't have kidney disease on the labs today. Labs don't look too bad. It could predict whether or not you're going to have kidney disease. This study used deep learning algorithms. They trained it on 158,000 images of patients' eyes or retinal photographs, and they combined clinical factors. They then had internal and external validation. The people that are doing this work are in the UK, and the UK has a data bank called the UK Biobank, and you can actually get access to this data. Like, as an informatics expert, you could just get access to the UK Biobank and do a project with Anne and myself. I hope you do that.
Yeah, for sure. That'd be great.
So they published this in The Lancet. So The Lancet is a British journal. So it's called Lancet Digital Health is the British AI journal. And it was AI for chronic kidney disease detection. Now, what they start with is the idea that screening for chronic kidney disease is challenging in a primary care setting, even in a high-income country. So there's an AI deep learning algorithm that could detect chronic kidney disease from a retinal image. Now, this one was just for chronic kidney disease. This one was specifically for diabetic kidney disease as well. So this was also published in Lancet Digital Health. So this first one was this was a original one was in 2020, but this one was in April of 2025. So the UK Biobank projects have been going on since 2020. Here's another case. A 34-year-old woman has hematuria. She has a flu-like respiratory illness. She has had several episodes of hematuria in the past 1 year, but CT scan shows no stones or masses. A final diagnosis is made by a kidney biopsy. Now, let's say you don't know what this is. Then I helped you out because this might be a scenario that you would see on the board exam. And believe it or not, I'm going to be retaking the board exam because I have to take it every 10 years in a year from now. So this might be on my board exam, might be on your board exam if you take it. Well, actually, we might be taking it at the same time. Who knows? If you see me at your board exam, it's not a mistake. So does anyone want to, I won't call on anyone, but does anyone have an idea of what kidney disease this might be before I reveal the diagnosis?
IgA.
Wow, you are correct. If I had an award, I would give it to you right now. I'm impressed. Yeah. So you're right. This is IgA nephropathy. That was really good. So to diagnose or prove the diagnosis in 2025, you have to do a biopsy. I don't know about you, but if it was me, I wouldn't want someone to put a needle in my kidney if there was another good way around it. And there is. And that is to use a machine learning model. So the machine learning model was trained and tested against the biopsy, and it basically eliminates the need to put a needle in someone's kidney. Just, I think this is amazing. This is the future of what medicine is going to be like. We're going to be able to not biopsy people and know with ground truth certainty that they have a diagnosis. This, to me, is so exciting. So this study was also published in Nature, not surprisingly, because it's a really great study. It's machine learning for IgA nephropathy, and it had 1,268 patients. And we have numbers that I like, meaning area under the curve that's 0.91, so it's in the 90% range. And they tried different machine learning models. Now, machine learning is not using, say, ChatGPT or large language models. It's different. So they compared XGBoost and Random Forest. And, you know, those are obviously better than something like logistic regression. So point is, you can use machine learning. And they found that the predictors that were the best were age, serum albumin, IgA, obviously, urine, red blood cells. So the point is that artificial intelligence can be used to diagnose acute kidney injury, chronic kidney disease, but specifically pathological subtypes of glomerulonephritis. Now, this is a pathology study in The Lancet. Let's see the date. November 2025. That's not too old. So in the pathology world right now, they still have to look at biopsy, real tissue on a slide, but you have probably heard me say this at some of the other talks, that what's happening is the pathology world is trying to go digital, just like radiology is all digital now. Like when we used to teach, we would have to put a film up and you would look at a film on a board. Now, nope, there's no film and there's no board. It's just digital. Well, that's pathology is still in the Stone Ages, and they're trying to do what radiology did, you know, a decade ago. They're trying to digitize everything. And when once you digitize it, then AI can look at the biopsy and tell you that diagnosis. So it's true in glomerular nephritis now. It's been validated in multi-center trials that, you know, AI can read the biopsy. So what about for polycystic kidney disease? It could be used for diagnosis, risk stratification, and therapy. These AI-enabled tools, now this is from October of 2025. You're like, why are you bringing up old stuff already? It's AI-enabled tools, particularly deep learning models, convolutional neural networks, so that's the tool we use to read images, convolutional neural networks. When you read, AI reads an image or an x-ray. So it can be used then to look and measure the total kidney volume, the segmentation, and it outperforms anything else that's out there right now. So not as good, it outperforms. So it's like going to be a very useful tool for this disease. So now today's November 11th. Okay, it says on November 11th. So on November 7th, that's 4 days ago, the American Society of Nephrology issued their statement on using artificial intelligence for kidney care. So this is really cutting edge. The nephrologist put this out 4 days ago. So I'm going to just kind of give you the bulleted points. What are the take-home messages? The first one is that for CKD, this reliance that we have on GFR is just not good enough anymore, that we need to start using AI in our diagnosis and treatment and not just rely on GFR. And so, for example, there's this ClinRisk model that uses lab data repositories on 5.8 million individuals and can predict CKD progression with only a CBC and metabolic panel urine albumin creatinine ratio with an error of the curve of 0.88. Now at Wake Forest, they're using this TravVis tool. So they implemented this. At Wake Forest is a large medical academic medical center in North Carolina. So it was a visual clinical decision support system. Now, this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Informatics Association. We are actually, in a few months, going to have the journal of our organization, the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. But this was for precision management of chronic kidney disease. So why would you, so this is a good example of informatics. So why would you do this? Because studies show that physicians don't follow guidelines well. So the nephrologists have these KDIGO guidelines, but doctors have a hard time adhering to guidelines. So AI models are able to improve, for example, making sure the patient got, you know, the urinary testing, or that the prescription of the guideline appropriate drugs were given to a patient with CKD. Now, we were at the oncology meeting at McCormick Place a few months ago, and the oncology organization partnered with Google to use their tool to help oncologists adhere to the ASCO oncology guidelines. Well, in a similar way, we can look at, can we use a tool like that to adhere to the KDIGO guidelines? And they compared ChatGPT as the AI tool or DeepSeek or Gemini. And these were then used to, for, this was a study about nutrition. You know, obviously chronic kidney patients have to be careful with their diet. And this was a study on dietary recommendations for patients with chronic kidney disease. All right, just to make it a little more engaging, I'm going to take a survey. How many people think that the Google product Gemini was the winner? You could raise your hand if Google was the winner. Remember, the Oncologists Association, ASCO, made their tool with Google. How many people think the Chinese product DeepSeek was the winner? Wow, I'm not fooling anybody. So the winner was, we basically had each of these tools make a dietary recommendation according to Kittagogue diet. Well, not surprising. I'm deep into all this literature. I'll just tell you straight out, most comparative studies on things show that ChatGPT tends to win compared to the other tools. Not that I'm promoting anything in particular. I'm just telling you what the studies are. And it doesn't matter if it's in nephrology or some other thing. So Ann and I use ChatGPT almost every minute of every day, if not every second of every minute of every day. So if you want, we can help you and how to do that for medicine or patient care. That's part of what these sessions are supposed to be about. All right, so adhering to guidelines, still on that topic, there's something called RAG. Now, you guys are using RAG, but you don't know it. And RAG is Retrieval Augmented Generation. We first learned about this a year ago at an AI conference in Orlando. And so the idea is a large language model like what I mentioned to you will search the entire internet, but the entire internet isn't scientific information. I could post anything I want on the internet, and then ChatGPT might quote some nonsense that I make up, right? So you kind of have to be careful as a doctor to use a large language model if it's sampling from the internet. So academic physicians like us decided, we need a tool that takes ChatGPT, but only gets it to the evidence, not the general internet. And that tool is called RAG, or Retrieval Augmented. Now, why do I say that all of you are using this? Because I surveyed you guys a few months ago, and the entire room, every resident in this program, raised their hand and said they were using open evidence. 100% of McNeil residents said they were using open evidence. Now, the way open evidence works is it takes ChatGPT and it uses retrieval augmented generation to sample only evidence-based literature. So that's why I'm saying you're doing it. You didn't realize you're doing it, but you're doing it. I'm going to survey you guys now. How many people in the last 7 days used open evidence? I'm just curious. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's not 100%, but that's not bad. 5. So 10, so 50% of the people used open evidence in the last week. So that's pretty good. So adherence to guidelines is still the topic. So large language models are 99% accurate in predicting whether you need to consult a nephrologist. They're very helpful for diagnostic reasoning of complex cases. If you use it with RAG, it answered kidney disease questions. Let's say, like, the nephrologists have a nephrosap, like a mix-up for nephrology fellows and attendings. It got 98% correct. I'll just tell you, humans don't get 98% correct. So, and then RAG enabled, but this is with RAG, right? And then RAG enabled guidelines aligned with recommendations in Kittagogue. So the point is, if you use a tool like Open Evidence, which is a ChatGPT with RAG, you're going to have 98 to 99% accuracy, which is far beyond what a human is capable of. What about for AKI? So again, all of these things are from the American Society of Nephrology statement that came out 4 days ago. Analyzing real patient data like trends in creatinine, urine output, vital signs, will give, you know, greater accuracy in predicting AKI. You can use it for real-time monitoring, dynamic risk stratification. But this is the important part. You can use AI then to help you manage someone in AKI with fluid adjustments and adjustment of medication dosing that might be nephrotoxic. So not just predicting things, but actually managing things. Now, what about in the ICU setting? You know, all of us take care of patients in the ICU setting. Many of them have renal disease or chronic kidney disease. Some need to have urgent dialysis. AI can be really helpful if you input the fluid balance, the electrolyte levels, and their hemodynamic numbers, the timing of when to do dialysis, because they can really become hypotensive in an ICU setting and not tolerate dialysis. So this reinforcement learning model could be effective in tailoring dialysis prescriptions to a patient's individual needs in an ICU setting, preventing hypotension. So for critical care nephrology, it could be helpful for acute kidney injury predicting, nephrotoxin surveillance, and preventing dialysis hypotension, and AI-guided dialysis. Now, I'll just tell you, it hasn't really been used yet in dialysis care in practice, but in research, it has. So it's useful in predictive modeling, treatment optimization, and decision support. Now, this is a really good use case is, you know, patients with dialysis have anemia. And obviously, we give them something like erythropoietin. And deciding on how much to give and when to give, AI can be useful in that regard. So there have been several recent publications on using it for anemia management as a decision support tool on the precise dose of the EPO-stimulating agents. And that it, using it as opposed to not using it led to significantly improved hemoglobin target rates and reduced medication use, and even a cost saving. So, you know, not giving the medicine when it wasn't needed, and better. But most important, the thing that I care about is it improved the patient's outcome. So this was just a very recent, within the last few weeks, this publication on using AI for personalized erythropoiesis stimulating agent dosing. So what about transplant? A big part of nephrology is transplant nephrology. So AI and machine learning tools can help with immunosuppressive. So there's been so many times, I don't know if you guys have experienced it, as a hospitalist, I got a patient that had had a transplant and comes on the transplant drugs. And it's not something that we do every day. We're not transplant nephrologists, right? So you can have AI help you with that in terms of the drug levels and the dosages. We would have to send off the levels and figure out what to do. And you have to try to reach their transplant nephrologist. It's like you start to step out of your comfort zone with that, at least for me. So I think that you can now have AI be your like transplant nephrology expert and help you with that. So you don't have to be like uncomfortable. So specifically the drug that I would always have to deal with, and I know you did as well, so occasionally, not too often, was the tacrolimus and what to do with that. You know, we have to send off a level and figure out the dosing. While they were in the hospital, if they're in the hospital here and if you don't have a transplant nephrology program at your hospital, you know, now you're having to wait to get input from their doctor on the management. So I covered a lot of new information. Most of this is just within the last few weeks, but this is exciting times. AI is now really impacting nephrology as a field, as you could see. And so what can you take home from the talk today? I'm going to disclose that AI generated this image for me. It's the only slide that was AI generated. I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting. It's a home, and then there's a heart, and then there's a sun. All right. So AI can screen for hypertension. Specifically, you could use it today on yourself or your patient if you have a smartwatch. You just have to install the app called HTNF, or Hypertension Notification Feature. Also, you could use the tool in Epic right now when you go out at that door to help you with prediction of kidney injury. Just be aware that it isn't the high 90s like we like to see, but it's better than nothing. And that AI could be a screening tool for kidney disease just from a retinal photograph. And that if you had a clinical picture, like I gave you, of someone with IgA nephropathy, and the next step is biopsy, you could actually legitimately avoid a biopsy and be as good as the biopsy using a machine learning tool. And that what you're going to see in your career soon, coming soon to a theater near you, is going to be using AI in dialysis care. And whether it's deciding on the prescription for dialysis or the transplant management for dosing of tacrolimus. So this is how to reach us. You could send me an email. More importantly, which you failed to do last time, is you got to go on our website, AmericanCollegeAIM.org. You could do it while you're in the room because you're going to be busy when you leave. And you just become a member. It's free as long as you're a resident or a fellow. So you're going to be a fellow soon, so you're still going to be free.
Great.
Yeah. And if you happen to find this interesting and you want to really go to the next level on all this, you can come to our conference. It's going to be in a year from now, roughly 11 months or something like that, and at McCormick Place in Chicago. Save the date, the 8th and 9th, a Friday and Saturday. And that will also be free for you if you're a resident or a fellow or a student, one of those three categories. All right, so this is where we open it up for questions. And it doesn't just have to be about nephrology. It could be about anything you want to talk about. It could be a therapy session if you want to have a group therapy or whatever. So anyone want to shoot out a question?
So probably just more of a comment about recent experience on AI. I'm not very used to using AI when it comes to clinical decision tools and supporting management. And I tried to do it recently. It didn't go so well. We had a case of a patient who came in with a suspected pulmonary embolism. We got an EKG, and it was showing the classic S1, QT, T3, Magin-like sign. According to some diagnostic accuracy studies, specificity of this test, of this finding, could go up easy above 90%. So we used OpenAI to see if this was a... what was the likelihood of this was actually me based on his findings. And we were surprised that the result was that, according to, was it Open Science, David? What was it?
Open evidence.
So they said it's not as specific. And the citing article for that claim was a New England Journal of Medicine article, which was a review article. So we went to the article, and we went to the site that was saying that it's not as specific. We went to the citation of that article, and it was a 1986 article that was showing no diagnostic accuracy analysis supporting that it was non-specific. So at that point, I realized that this is a very powerful tool in many situations, but it's not providing the kind of the key part of the story, which is a critical analysis of evidence. Mm-hmm. That was my experience. There is just like this filtering down process that might miss sometimes I think one of the most important aspects of evidence, which is a critical analysis of all that information. So by the end, we considered the patient to be at a high risk of PE based on all the full picture. But if we just used the AI model, it was actually a low risk patient. So that was just my.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, so the takeaway on PE is this, that AI is obviously being deployed in radiology departments, and the tool, there's a tool for PE detection, and what's the tool that's made and deployed, it's basically just they call it operating in the background, meaning you don't have to order a PE protocol test. It's just kind of looking at scans that were done for any reason and trying to detect whether or not there's a PE. So, but that wouldn't help in your case if no scan of any kind was done. But AI is helpful, and it's being deployed for PE detection so that it doesn't get missed. But an imaging test has to be done in order to detect it, you know, so it doesn't get missed. So in your case, you were trying to decide, should we order an imaging test or not? So anyway, I like your example. Thanks for sharing that.
I like that you went to the source. So anything we're going to use from AI or ChatGPT, if you're going to use it for something like that, it's not just, you know, the local restaurant, which went better. Now you're going to have something that's going to impact the patient. We have to verify if it's actually there. Did you say that was 1986?
86.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
So this was open evidence. I'm curious what ChatGPT would say.
Well, but ChatGPT, open evidence is ChatGPT, though.
I know.
It is.
Open evidence was citing the article from New England Journal of Medicine, which was published in 2024. Well, the citing article from the new, because that was a review article.
That was review, but the article within the article
was
from
the primary source of the review article was 1986. So we pull out a meta-analysis published in 2020, with three big articles on diagnostic accuracy analysis, and the specificity was more than 90%.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was our experience with them.
And actually, I was telling Dr. Gooden earlier that regarding the use of open evidence, the AI tool, like I'm doing a project on precisely that, like is within MedEd, like clinical reasoning and how residents are using this tool. Maybe you can chat later, but it basically, if we don't have this routinely or this habit of criticizing the even the prompts from AI, like reviewing the sources, like sometimes I feel like we're gonna miss things, we're gonna go with misleading workup or with misleading treatments. So I think it's also part of the things that we need to learn with the AI, you know, how to use the AI's tool instead of replacing our, you know,
judgment.
Well,
the answer is in what you just said. It's a tool.
Yeah. So some people.
Okay.
I guess the risk.
You know, if
are,
you have a hammer, that's a tool.
Yes.
You need somebody to guide that, right?
You use for some other, or you know, inappropriately. I think there are risks, but
yes.
I guess our job is to help other people to, you know, use it properly. And
well, how about the lawyer who had the case and it just made it up? They used AI to write a report and they just wrote a case, you know, precedence and whatever the case was. They just made it up. But they didn't validate. They didn't validate it, the person. And I think the company's still using it, right?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So you guys are very smart to go to the source and see if it's, you know, there's hallucinations. But it's a tool.
Yeah.
So we should feel comfortable that it's not going to replace us. Not yet.
So interestingly, it took you to the source information so you could look it up.
Yes.
So that's key.
If you're going to ask a question, the tool, I mean, it ask for the source, it's right there. Go and look at it. So, you know, excellent work that you're doing that. And not just taking the easy way out and just doing whatever it said. But the sources are all there. It's very easy to do that. But we do that. We validate.
Yeah, I agree. So use the tool, but validate. That's the message. Yeah.
Right.
All right. More questions. So far, this has been a good discussion by questions. Anyone else? How about throwing out a question just for fun?
I'm interested, like, from your aspect, what do you think are the latest advancements of AI in rheumatology specifically? Any specific aspect that you think is most interesting or promising?
Well, two things. One is obviously the most power in AI up until now has been in imaging. So reading rheumatology x-rays, seeing patterns in, say, a hand x-ray or a bone x-ray that maybe the human eye can't see, that's for sure like where a wealth of opportunity is. But also, just like we saw with treatment options with drugs, it may be helpful in personalizing what treatment to give someone when it's the immunosuppressives, like for rheumatoid arthritis or other diseases where it's immunosuppressive. So for example, in oncology, there's this precision oncology where they tailor the drug therapy to the individual one patient. Well, I think you will be able to do that in rheumatology. You will be doing that in rheumatology, where instead of this patient with RA gets, boom, this combo, it's going to be more personalized. Mm-hmm. You're going to look at details of that specific patient. Some of it might be their images. Some of it might be their labs. Some of it might be things that the human eye can't see, but AI could analyze the data and then say, no, this drug is going to be better than this drug for this patient. That's kind of this whole notion of precision medicine. I think that's going to really tie into your career in rheumatology. So, but that's good. All right. Well, thank you guys for coming, and we're going to be back again in a few months to cover a different body part. Yep. All right. Have a great day, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. John here. Thanks for listening to another episode. If you enjoyed what you heard here today, please check us out on our website, www.AmericanCollegeAIM.org. Sign up today to become a member. And don't forget to save the dates, October 9th and October 10th, 2026, here in Chicago at McCormick Place Convention Center. We're having our second annual scientific session. Special shout out to everybody who joined us in 2025. You all made it amazing. Thanks so much for coming. We hope to see you all next year. Don't forget to sign up right away. www.AmericanCollegeAIM.org. We'll see you then. Bye, guys.